Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. David Hume, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 4.
In this account of sympathy, Hume shows how human feelings can rise above limited or myopic self-interest. Sympathy is not just a mechanism in Hume's moral theory, it's a fundamental element of the social world.
The minds of men are mirrors to one another. To this principle, we ought to ascribe the great uniformity we may observe in the humors and turn of thinking of those of the same nation. And it is much more probable that this resemblance arises from sympathy than from any influence of the soil and climate, which, though they continue invariably the same, are not able to preserve the character of a nation the same for a century together.
Hume faces a third challenge because of his belief that moral apprehension is a kind of feeling. So far, Hume has said that people get along with each other because they are sociable, and that they're sociable because they have sympathy for one another. This view leaves an open question. Even if a person is sympathetic, why should he or she adopt the social perspective? We can state this question another way. Even if we agree that I will feel a fraternal, brotherly affection if I adopt the social perspective, why would I or why should I choose on occasion to adopt that perspective? Hume agonized over this last challenge, but he finally asserted that every human being has the sentiment of humanity. Hume believes that everyone has a concern for the interests of others. Here he follows the lead of another important British moral theorist, Bishop Butler. Hume argues that the distinction between selfishness and benevolence is usually misrepresented. The idea that human beings are benevolent because benevolence gives us a selfish pleasure misconstrues both benevolence and selfishness. To be selfish is to be indifferent to or hostile to the interests of others. To be benevolent is to be vitally concerned for and sensitive to the interests of others, without involving self-interest. We may get pleasure out of being benevolent, let us say to our children, but our pleasure doesn't motivate or explain our benevolence. Hume's not foolish enough to maintain that we're never selfish or that we always put others before ourselves. Rather, he maintains that we have both naturally benevolent impulses about our family and friends, and we do have a concern for the welfare of others. We have the capacity to admire the good fortune of others, and that's what our humanity is all about. A more subtle issue is found in conflicts between the interests of people in a moral community. Hume makes clear that any moral theory must presuppose that, in principle, all moral conflicts between people are resolvable. To make this presupposition intelligible, we must recognize that there's nothing fixed or permanent about any interest. Our self-interest is not permanently fixed. It is both inherited from the social world into which we're born, and it can be modified as circumstances change. One of the most remarkable claims of Hume's moral theory is that we're not born with a moral sense. He says we acquire it from a developmental social process. We take justice and other social rules seriously at first, simply because it's to our advantage. Afterwards, we identify with the larger social whole in ways that go beyond narrow self-interest. Hume thinks this is true not only in the founding of societies, but in the moral development of children.
Thus, self-interest is the original motive to the establishment of justice. But a sympathy with public interest is the source of the moral approbation which attends that virtue.
We can't simply teach children in some automatic way to become moral. All of us must first have the capacity for humanity, and since we're given that capacity, it can be cultivated. Unlike the philosopher Thomas Hobbes and later utilitarian thinkers such as Jeremy Bentham, Hume rejects the view that moral ideas can be attributed to the individual only. He says moral ideas are connected to a person's relationships with others. From the very beginning, we're cared for by others, and it's obvious that human beings are social animals. Any moral speculation must begin by recognizing that a social background is already in place. For Hume, there is no human nature totally independent of culture and history. So Hume forthrightly rejects the social contract theory sometimes used by others, like John Locke and Thomas Hobbes, to explain the origin of the community. Social contract theory presupposes that it's meaningful to talk about the self-interest of human agents before they're social members. It argues that we accept the social interest because it's a convenient way of satisfying self-interest. Hume says that it makes no sense to talk about solitary individuals coming together to discuss forming a community unless there was a pre-existing community. He denies that we have a self-interest independent of our membership in such a community, and he insists that people will develop a real sense of moral obligation, which is not a disguised selfishness.
It is utterly impossible for men to remain any considerable time in that savage condition which precedes society. But that his very first state and situation may justly be esteemed social.
So far, we've been discussing Hume's attempt to show how a moral consensus is possible, even though our moral apprehension is emotional rather than cognitive or intellectual. A moral consensus is possible, according to Hume, because all human beings have a sense of humanity, a capacity to feel pleasure at the good fortune of others. We can be moral because we can, through sympathy, adopt a social perspective. We've seen that the first great issue of modern moral theory is whether there's an inwardly discoverable moral domain. The second great issue has been how we have access to that moral domain. The third great issue to emerge in modern moral theory has to do with moral motivation, or more specifically, the relationship between moral apprehension and moral motivation. Hume sided with those who claim that moral apprehension is a matter of feeling. He also shown how it still is possible to have uniform feelings among a group of people, or what's called an intersubjective consensus of feeling. He next tells us that his explanation of morality makes much more sense than the explanations of those who appeal to abstract reason. He says that the major shortcoming of all theories based on reason is that they fail to account for the practical impact of morality. For example, controversial moral topics like abortion or pornography are sometimes very difficult to define, yet they can stimulate powerful emotions. Even a U.S. Supreme Court justice has said that pornography cannot be strictly defined, but I know it when I see it. Such attitudes represent the practical impact of morality. According to Hume, no moral theory is adequate unless it can explain how morality influences our behavior.
If morality had naturally no influence on human passions and actions, it were in vain to take such pains to inculcate it, and nothing would be more fruitless than the multitude of rules and precepts with which all moralists abound. Philosophy is commonly divided into speculative and practical, and as morality is always comprehended under the latter division, it is supposed to influence our passions and actions, and to go beyond the calm and indolent judgments of the understanding. And this is confirmed by common experience, which informs us that men are often governed by their duties, and are deterred from some actions by the opinion of injustice, and impelled to others by that of obligation.
Hume believes that moral apprehension is itself emotional, so it therefore can have a direct link with motivation. At the same time, Hume condemns the major philosophical and religious theories passed down to us in Western civilization. He says they fail to explain this connection between recognizing what is right and acting morally.
Nothing is more usual in philosophy and even in common life than to talk of the combat of passion and reason, to give the preference to reason, and to assert that men are only so far virtuous as they conform themselves to its dictates. Every rational creature, it is said, is obliged to regulate his actions by reason, and if any other motive or principle challenged the direction of his conduct, he ought to oppose it until it be entirely subdued, or at least brought to a conformity with that superior principle. On this method of thinking, the greatest part of moral philosophy, ancient and modern, seems to be founded. Nor is there an ampler field, as well from metaphysical arguments as popular declamations, than this supposed preeminence of reason above passion. The eternity, invariableness, and divine origin of the former have been displayed to the best advantage. The blindness, inconstancy, and deceitfulness of the latter have been as strongly insisted on.
And what is Hume's response to all this? He declares his intention.
To show the fallacy of all this philosophy.
Hume's argument is quite simple. Reason discovers facts or logical relationships, but this information is useful only if we already have certain desires. Without prior desires, information by itself will not move us.
It is one thing to know virtue, and another to conform the will to it.
Those who find the source of morality in reason are called moral rationalists. Hume claims that moral rationalists are forced to distinguish between what is and what ought to be. But the trouble with this distinction is that the moral rationalists are never able to explain what the word ought means.
In every system of morality which I have hitherto met with, I have always remarked that the author proceeds for some time in the ordinary way of reasoning and establishes the being of a god, or makes observations concerning human affairs, when, of a sudden, I'm surprised to find that instead of the usual copulations of propositions is and is not, I meet with no proposition that is not connected with an ought or an ought not.
The moral rationalists have created a gap between what is and what ought to be. According to Hume, they can't explain this gap, so they try to invoke all kinds of mysterious relations. But these also can't be explained. In Hume's theory, there is no such gap because our moral sentiments are directly tied to the passions. He therefore rejects the whole notion of a special status for what ought to be. He doesn't deny we have obligations. Rather, when he speaks about obligation, he speaks about actual moral feelings we might have. He says these feelings are directly connected to our actions. So there is no gap between our feelings and our actions, between what is and what ought to be.
All morality depends upon our sentiments. And when any action or quality of the mind pleases us after a certain manner, we say it is virtuous. And when the neglect or non-performance of it displeases us after a like manner, we say that we lie under an obligation to perform it.
Hume's under no illusion about man's capacity to be blind, foolish, short-sighted, vicious, and self-deceptive. Almost everyone will agree that human beings are capable of being moral or immoral. The question is how we can understand that capability. Hume contends that theoretically there is no ultimate conflict between our moral motives and our non-moral motives. The practical problem is to teach people how to understand their own motives. Any practical success requires us to recognize that the desire to be reasonable is itself a passion. So instead of telling people to repress passion in favor of reason, an essentially hopeless and misguided task, we should guide them in cultivating some passions instead of others.
To drop all figurative expression, what hopes can we ever have of engaging mankind to a practice which we confess full of austerity and rigor? Or what theory of morals can ever serve any useful purpose unless it can be shown by a particular detail that all the duties which it recommends are also the true interest of each individual? The peculiar advantage of my system seems to be that it furnishes proper mediums for that purpose.
Hume insists that there's a moral dimension to human experience. If we have specifically moral motives along with our non-moral motives, then there must be some way to reconcile potential conflict. Here we've arrived at the fourth and final major issue in Hume's moral theory. If we believe that moral motives are reducible to non-moral motives, that is, that moral motives are only self-interest in disguise, then there would be no fundamental difference between Hume's views and those of Hobbes and Mandeville. Hume understands this and resists it. He persistently rejects the idea that morality is reducible to self-interest. Hume thinks that believing in God or in natural law doesn't guarantee a harmony between self-interest and the larger social good. Nor is self-interest ultimately transcended by identifying with some social whole. The great German philosopher Hegel was later to make this famous claim during the 19th century. Instead, Hume argues that moral motivation is a developmental process that's both natural and conventional. It's natural because of our capacity for sympathy, an emotion that can reconcile conflicts among self-interest, moral motives, and the social good. It's conventional in the sense that moral standards are partly based on conventions, on habits formed over time. Hume sought to transcend the conflict over moral motivation in a completely novel way. He appealed to the notion that the moral sense has developed continuously throughout history. Hume's moral theory is a revolutionary response to the great issues of modern moral philosophy. He recognizes that there's an inwardly discoverable moral domain. He says that we discover the moral domain through feeling. He forges a direct link between moral feelings and moral action, and he reconciles conflicts between moral and non-moral motives by appealing to sympathy. We've seen that David Hume's mind ranged over topics from the history of England to economics and to moral philosophy. His work in these areas alone would have earned him a place as one of the greatest philosophers in history. Yet, as we'll see, Hume also contributed to our understanding of religion and to the philosophy of physics. Only a few thinkers in history have given us as many gifts as David Hume.
This is the end of part 4. Please download part 5 to continue.